The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Gia Tolentino became a staff writer for The New Yorker in 2016 after writing and editing at the website Jezebel. I think she's helped to shape the modern New Yorker voice far more than The New Yorker has helped shape Gia's, and I'm very grateful for that. The range of her reference is so wide, it's a little hard to characterize. Culture, political issues, all kinds of obsessions. But one of Gia's big topics is what it's meant to her as a 30-year-old to have grown up on the internet. And she tracks how our digital world has evolved from the early, freer days of the web into one dominated by social media giants. Gia Tolentino writes about all of this in her new collection of essays called Trick Mirror, Reflections on Self-Delusion. The book appears in the number two spot for nonfiction on the New York Times bestseller list. So the first sentence of the first essay begins like the Bible. In the beginning, the internet seemed good. And now you describe the internet in the very same essay as this feverish, electric, unlivable hell, and we're becoming, as you say, increasingly sad and ugly on the internet. Tell me a little bit about that, because I did not grow up with the internet. Why does that change consciousness and everything else?
But were your first experiences of the internet as a place that could surprise you? I think that's where that, you know, my early experiences with the internet, and I was like, you know, a fifth grader or whatever, but it seemed like this place where you were free to discover things, and you could discover things in private, and it was just pleasure, and it was generative, and it was, you know, it was this zone of a new type of freedom. You were sort of free to be yourself. And increasingly, as the internet revolved to be constructed of social networks that revolve around personal identity, it began to seem like the feeling changed. The internet no longer became a place where things would surprise you. The internet became a place where everyone was looking at the same stuff and it was miserable. And everyone was sort of chained to themselves rather than free to be themselves.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. You write that when you were 10 years old, that you had something called an angel fire page, something I'm not quite sure what the hell that is, and you wrote something called The Story of How Gia Got Her Web Addiction by Gia.
I was blogging.
Age 10. You were already blogging.
Whereas, I was blogging. Where, love to blog.
But what were the specifics? What were the specifics of the things that you were getting at 10, 11?
Well, you know, I was 10, so I was like, oh, I heard this Smash Mouth song on the radio. Let me look up the lyrics,
right?
You know, or just the idea that you could discover a website dedicated to something like trees or Ricky Martin or, you know, or like Lord of the Rings, right? Like you could just, the internet seemed to contain, it was like, what it felt like to me was a neighborhood that you could walk through and you could just go into these houses that would be decorated with, you know, all of these things you'd never seen before. And then you could leave.
You've got a quote from Jason Kotke, who was an early voice on the internet and one of the original celebrity bloggers. And he writes, the web is the place for you to express your thoughts and feelings and such. To put those things elsewhere seems absurd, unquote. Now, the personal essay was not invented by the internet. Personal writing, right. The writing about the self was not invented by any of these things. What is he getting at here?
Right. So right around the time that he was writing that was when blogging began its transition between being a hobby and being kind of a foundation for, you know, a readily monetizable practice and a career. And I think, and that's something that I think is interesting, right? Like the internet, the way we render ourselves for other people on the internet, it's not that different from how we render ourselves for each other in real life, right? Like talking about ourselves, thinking about our narratives, self-presentation in general, it's certainly not internet specific. But that transition and the monetization of that transition, it's sort of like To put these thoughts elsewhere, but where you could monetize them, starts to feel absurd, I think. I think that's sort of the underlying thing in that.
Is that what
that
you're
quote.
Experiencing now as a bestseller? Do you think that the reason that it's a bestseller is not for the old conventional reasons, but at least in part because of a social media, I don't know, presence or voice?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly...
Because that seems crazily self-deprecating to me. These essays are so good, and they've obviously connected to an audience. And you obviously with presence in the Hairpin and Jezebel and thank God the New Yorker. It's hard for me to believe that just because you're amusing or otherwise on Twitter, that you're amusing on Twitter, that's the reason this book is taken off.
Yeah, I mean, I would hope it's because I have, you know, consistently been a writer that people are down to read. But it's also, you know, the thing about the internet, right, it's been this sort of civically corrosive, it's this nightmare at the center of our culture and life. At the same time, it's the only reason I have a job, you know. I don't think I would have ended up in media at all if it wasn't for the internet. And I think that's, you know, it's a question of, I think this is a question that I just think about so much generally. It's how systems that are corrosive, how many corrosive systems have benefited me and how they continue to. Like capitalism and patriarchy, right? Like systems that are punishing and horrible, but that I have somehow managed to benefit from in some way.
Did you ever consider radically changing your relationship with the internet and kind of walking away from it or something different because it's starting to get its tentacles around you too much?
I'm actually not that uncomfortable with the way I use the internet because a couple years back, actually, when I started working at The New Yorker, I no longer had to monitor the news cycle in the same way because I didn't have to be interested in everything.
Right, you weren't writing 72 times a day.
Yeah, I wasn't writing 72 times a day. I wasn't editing 500 things a day. And I deliberately, I could feel at the end of Jezebel, I mean, which was one of the reasons that I was like, wow, this job offer is a miracle, because I could feel that my attention span was just, it was corroded to nothing. I could feel that I couldn't calibrate what I actually cared about from what was, you know, what everyone was talking about. I just, being on the internet constantly had done something to me. And that was when I was like, okay, you were going to keep this to a daily minimum and it'll still be more than what is probably humanly appropriate, but you were going to keep this to a minimum and you're going to interact with the internet through a lens of pleasure. And, you know, this is the only way you're going to, survive being a writer in this day and age and a writer of your, you know, demographic and cohort, you know. That's the only way.
Well, are there writers in your reading experience, in your spiritual experience, that were the model for you in some way?
There are a lot of essay writers that there's like, you know, like Sontag and Didion, and I loved Ellen Willis's Village Voice criticism, and I love Rebecca Solnit and Zadie Smith and Leslie Jameson and Eula Biss. Actually, Zadie in particular, I remember reading her first collection of nonfiction and being so struck by how forceful she was as an intellect, but how clear it was that she understood that she could be wrong about anything she was saying. And that was a real, like, that really did something to me,
well,
you know?
Well, neither one of you, well, maybe she more than you, concludes in a given essay. All these, the nine essays in Trick Mirror, they don't set out a thesis, tease it through, and then conclude in a standard way. They, as you say, they take the rock and put it under the light and look at it from all angles, and you argue with yourself, you digress, you joke, you come back, you tell a story. It's a curvy journey.
It's a curvy journey. It doesn't really land anywhere. I wanted that, right? It's like, that's how my brain feels now. Like, I think that was actually that was the animating impulse for the book, was I want clarity about the moment that we're in. I need it to function. It was like post-election. I was just like, I need to understand the world clearer than I do, but I cannot ever re-enter that place of certainty that I was in pre-election, because it's no longer correct to the world that we live in. And I was trying to figure out a way to do both at the same time. And I just never feel conclusive anymore. Do you know what I mean? Do you feel?
I do. But, you know, I'm in the conclusive business sometimes because I'm writing these political comments or we have to get a magazine out and there's a conclusiveness to that. This is a different thing that you're doing. Tell me this. As a person who's been trolled repeatedly online, what's the right way to deal with trolls?
I think an important thing for online behavior is don't take the bait. You know, I mean, it's different. I think it's also, you know, there are different degrees of it, right? There are some women writers that get death threats constantly, you know, that get SWAT teams sent to their house, you know, who get the, you know, letters sent to their parents' house, all this stuff, right? I don't get that. I just get emails calling me a bitch and, you know, sending me pictures of aborted fetuses and, like, you know, saying disgusting stuff. Like, that's okay.
That's okay.
And I mean, it's not okay.
It sounds horrible.
As Whitney Houston said, it's not right, but it's okay. And it is horrible, but, you know, for better, like, this is, something that I worried about at Jezebel, that I got so used to this. Mm-hmm. And I worried about what that was doing to my heart, you know? If I have a heart that's hard enough to take this in my email every day and think it's okay. I didn't want that. I wanted to be a little more sensitive. And I was afraid that that would make me, I was afraid that brushing off unfair criticism would make me brush off fair criticism. One of the things that I try to do is to not take the bait if I can afford to not to, which, you know, it's right. If you're getting death threats, you have to take the bait. You have to report them. But if I'm just getting mean emails, one thing that I try to do is understand, like, do I have more power than these people? Do I have more security than them? Like, do I need to respond? If I don't, I try not to take the bait. And it's the same with, like Trump tweets on Twitter, right? Like, everyone retweeting Trump, like, sir, Mr. President, like, this isn't, it's like, we're taking the bait, you know? We shouldn't take the bait.
What do you mean we shouldn't take the bait? We shouldn't pay attention to when the President of the United States tweets as in racist terms or misogynistic terms? What should we do about that?
I mean, that's the question of what it is to be in this field right now, right? But I do think that this idea that, like, I don't mean we shouldn't engage with what Trump is saying, but I do think that there's a certain thing that Twitter monetizes and systematizes where, you know, trying to, like, dunk on the president, you know, seems like a useful thing to do, like trying to get, like, it sort of incentivizes this thing where you have this response to Trump that goes viral and then, like, gets more attention to you and benefits you. And that is something, I think the internet creates a situation where opposition can sometimes serve us.
Mm. I've always thought in my job that I sense that there are some writers that love the activity of writing.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who like having written, which is to say they love the fact that there's this book and it's done, but the act of doing it is so consuming, painful, boring, lonely, unsure, that they hate the actual activity. They love having done it. Where do you fall on that?
I'm 100%. Like, I mean, I guess I'm glad that the book is done. I'm glad that I wrote it. But I love the agony of writing, right? I think, and, like, this might be, you know, the sort of self-flagellating holdover from having grown up in a, you know, the Southern Baptist church. But it's like, I think you saying that just now made me think that's kind of how I want to live in the world, you know? Mm. Like uncertainty and agony and work and devotion, you know, and sustained attention. I think that's a way that I want to be in the world. And writing is the way that I can do that. The fact of having time to think about something in private before it becomes public still feels like a real miracle to me. And that's what I want. You know, like, that's this thing that I still crave more than anything.
Gia, thanks.
Thanks, David. Bye.
Gia Tolentino is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and her book, Trick Mirror, is out now.